Hello, everyone. Welcome to our podcast / videocast. Want to introduce Barbara Guggenheim. Barbara is the founder of the art consultancy firm Guggenheim Asher Associates. The company's with offices in New York and Los Angeles has been in business for more than 25 years. Barbara has built collections for corporations, including Coca-Cola and Sony, and numerous individuals, including celebrities like Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg. She currently advises a handful of our clients, which is how we came to know Barbara. Barbara holds a PhD in art history from Columbia University, has taught at the college level, lectured at the Whitney Museum, and has worked at the auction houses Sotheby's and Christie's. She has written what today is considered by many to be the definitive book on the art world, called Art World, The New Rules of the Game. As an art advisor, Barbara specializes in helping her clients make wise decisions with regard to investing in art. And with that, Barbara, thank you for joining us. Mark, why don't you kick us off with our first question?
Barbara, thank you again for spending time and sharing your knowledge with our clients and the people that we know. As financial advisors, we often look at different asset classes and say, how do you access this asset class? How do you invest in this asset class? And I know that there's many reasons that people collect art and create art collections, but most specifically, when did this sort of craze for collecting art begin? You know, how did it get started? Do people generally collect art for the love of art, or is there a legitimate reason to collect art from an investment standpoint and view it as a separate asset class from some of the things that they might already be invested in?
I think it is an asset class. It's taken a lot of Wall Street, a lot of time to figure that out and quantify it. Probably the first time that that was done was the British Rail Pension Union, which in 1972 invested 2% of what they had under management in art. They used Sotheby's as their advisor, and they bought across the road from the antiquities right on up to modern art. And in 1989, at the high point of the Impressionist market, they sold their Impressionist paintings. It was the first time people could sit and look at documents and actually see that art was a good investment. People knew that, however, for a long time. Even back in the Renaissance, they understood the power of art. The Medici were commissioning, patronizing the artists in order to really manage the conversation. A sculpture, for example, by Verrocchio of David with the head of Goliath meant something to the community. Hey, we're a small duchy and we're going to beat everybody else. And people collected them. There's a Duchess of Mantua, Isabella d'Este, had 28,000 letters we have to her advisor saying, get me this, get me that. And one of them was really funny because she said, I'm desperate for another Giorgione. And he writes back, sorry, Giorgione's already dead. And then the Brits took the grand tour in the 18th and 19th century, and they had made money in the Midlands, had money to burn, and they were going to buy scenes by Canaletto of Venice to show how worldly they were. They didn't think they were worth anything. They were just spending money to outdo their neighbors. Then at the turn of the century, as we all know from Downton Abbey, when they became land rich but money poor, they realized they could sell these paintings out of the back door of their homes. So if you remember the Downton Abbey chapter where they do sell a Renaissance painting to support a land development they want to do. And even when I started, people didn't dare utter the word art and money in the same sentence. Now it's done all the time. After a few years of helping people would come to me and say, look, I just don't want to be a jerk. The prices are starting to go up. Just help guide me so I don't lose money. Now people expect to make money as well as buy what they love. So people believe they can have it all.
So I think that brings us to the next question. As a layperson, somebody who has a thought that I would like to collect art, I think a very difficult thing for many people to assess is, what is the value of a painting? What is the value now? What will cause that value to increase or decrease over time? How do you get into this and evaluate the merits of any particular piece of art based on what it might be worth now and what it might do in the future?
That's the million-dollar question. Knowledge is power. The issue is, what does that take? And we can look at a lot of different barometers. If, for example, there is no one art world, people come up to me all the time and say, hey, how's the art world? Well, the market for Picasso works differently than the market for Warhol or the market for Basquiat and so forth. So each artist and each school of painting has its own market to be considered, not just the overall art market. So, for example, look at Picasso and look at Warhol. Tremendous supply, tremendous demand. So it's an orderly market. And you don't have to sell yours to find one on the market. As you said before, that it was fungible. They're not the same. So how do you quantify them? You don't have to sell one to find one that's very similar to yours. So in both of those artists, you can kind of assess your net worth as you go along. And I think that's important to some people. Some people they want to make investments in art like they do with you. Some people are much more risk tolerant. Some people only want the blue chip. And now there's something called red chip, which are the young artists that are so hot that they skip over the primary market. They go straight to auction. And if you want one and can't get one in the gallery, you pay 10, 20 times what they are in the gallery. If you look at a painting, it's very difficult. But as I always say, it's a matter of training, and it takes a village to be a successful artist. You have to go with the right dealer. That dealer has to make sure that you go in the right exhibitions. That dealer has to make sure that the right collectors and the right museums buy your work. I have one client who says, don't bother me until the painting is worth $500,000, because I know then that other people are invested in this artist and will make sure that the artist ends in an upward trajectory. I'm not sure that's always true, because sometimes you've heard the phenomenon of pump and dump, but now it's more pump and move on. But if you show your first image in figurative art, there are certain rules. So for example, if you show the image of the woman standing in front of the painting, this is a painting by Baldessari called Tips for Artists Who Want to Sell. And it talks about the market for realistic imagery. So paintings with light colors sell for more than paintings with dark colors. Madonna and child, landscape, flower, still lifes are better than others. But subject matter is important. It's been said that paintings with cows and hens in them collect dust, while the same paintings with bulls and roosters sell. Strangely enough, that can make a difference between 10, 15, 20% on the cost of an old master painting. If you look at the next slide for a minute, you'll see the trajectory of artists doesn't always go up. Not too long ago, about 2014, an artist named Christian Rosa was on everybody's tongue. Christian Rosa, Christian Rosa. And you see down at the bottom in September 2014, a painting at Phillips brought $87,500. You see in November, just 2 months later, a painting brings $209,000. And then you see a few years later, a very nice painting brings $13,000. So the market doesn't always move up and stay up. However, sometimes it does, if you put on the next slide. This is the same painting that came up twice, first at Sotheby's in 2018 and brought $2,775,000. And a year later, it brought $3,735,000. That's a cool million in a year. It doesn't always happen. How much would the painting be today? It would have gone up even more because the artist condo is quite sought after. and still maintains a market. He's the one in the painting. He's painting a painting in the movie, The Price of Everything. And he actually sells the painting before he finishes it. While we're on this page, I wanted you to look at the header, which is ArtNet Price Database, which is very useful in determining how much something is. But when you do look at it, you have to look and see if the painting you're considering has come up before, what's it brought. And you can sort in different ways. So you can sort the market price most expensive, or you can sales dates from current going backwards. I like doing that because it tells me the trajectory of the market. What you can see on this database is the condition of the works. So even if you might find a painting that's similar to the one that you're considering, you don't know if it was in good condition or not. And then you have the phenomenon of people who can't get what they want privately or don't buy privately, only buy at auction and feel more comfortable, see this painting by condo, see what its track record was. And if they want one, they're hedge funders and they just had a $200 million year. What does it matter to them if they spend an extra $500,000 or $1 million if they get exactly what they want? And if two people feel that way, then the prices can go up dramatically.
It just brings to mind a question. So you showed us two different examples. One artist who was on a positive trajectory and went from 80,000 to 200 and something thousand down to 13,000. You'd kind of look at that as like a broken internet stock. And you have another one that is on a trajectory that continues to climb higher. As an advisor, what might you have looked at in the first case that might have warned you that this might be an investment that wouldn't be appreciating? And what is it about the second painting that might have led you to believe this is something that will continue to increase in value?
If you're considering speculating, which is different than collecting, it's like penny stocks. You pick a number and you say, I'm going to pay whatever that is. Let's say your idea of fund money is 10,000, someone else's is 100,000, and I'm just going to buy whatever I like. You can look at the track record of the artist. Has the show at the gallery been sold out? Is he in any group shows? Is the gallery a good gallery for managing the artist? Were they put in the right collections and so forth? And that tends to propel an artist forward. It goes back to taking a village. As far as the intrinsic characteristics of the painting, everybody's always looking for the next generation of abstract painters. But for example, what has become quite hot during COVID is artists of color and realism. And the inequities of race and gender that we're dealing with in society reflect also in collecting. So suddenly older women who've died and never got their due, like Joan Mitchell, are suddenly being reconsidered, recontextualized. For example, there's a show coming in Paris of Monet and Joan Mitchell. She lived in Giverny where Monet lived. So there's a relationship between those two artists. And the idea of realism, because it looks better on the internet and imagery. And I think that's crazy, but it's really true. And people are buying the last year or two almost wholly on images they find on the internet, not going out and seeing the thick impasto paint or whatever an abstract artist may be doing.
Barbara, how would a client or an investor of yours start? You know, it seems so overwhelming. If you have an interest in art, you have an appreciation for art, you have significant wealth, what are the first few steps to going down this process of moving from an interested person to an engaged investor in the art world?
Obviously, as I'm an art advisor, I think that's the way to go, because I think you need to get an education. It doesn't have to be me, it can be anyone, but good advisors would educate the client first. I always say there are lots of things you have to do, but there's one no. And that is you and your spouse are walking down the street in Santa Fe and having the time of your life, or Miami, and you wander into a gallery and you say, wouldn't this be great? And we'll have something to remember our vacation by. Call me, collect. Don't do it. I always tell my clients, do not buy anything the first several months unless something just knocks you over the head. Let's see what you could possibly be interested in. Let's see what your budget is. Some people get to a point in their life, their children are of a certain age. They want a hobby to do together, or they're building a new house. These are all the starting factors. And especially that's when you need to buy art. But I think the first 6 months, it's good just to go for the education, go to a lot of exhibitions, go to a lot of galleries, subscribe to magazines, read some books, and talk to your local curators and your local gallerists and see what shows they're having and what they're thinking.
Do your clients generally engage you to say, look, this is the type of art that I like. Let's find the best pieces at the best values. Or do a lot of your clients come, as kind of Craig was outlining, this is new to me. I want to create something as an investment, but also find things that I like. What brings clients to you most of the time?
Well, sometimes people know what they like and they can't express it. Sometimes I think I'm like a shrink. My job is to pull out of a person what they like. And I think it's very important to build a strategy, because it's very hard to get good primary market works if you want them. And you're competing with museums and you're competing with very important dealers. But if you have a strategy, like, let's say, African-American images of women, or I have a client who was in the management consultant business, hit on this idea, he liked processing, collecting sculptors' drawings. Well, he was put to the head of the line for every one because he became a known figure on the scene. And then when he made more money, he collected the sculpture, and he had two exhibitions in museums, catalogs, and got a big bang for the buck. His works became much more valuable along the way. So I think you can accomplish both. Love what you buy. There's enough to love that also will go up in value. I think what you can't do is do what the Joneses do. However, I have a client who wrote me a letter that said, I am a hopeless name dropper, and I want paintings that people who come to my house know when they enter. So everybody dances to a different drum.
A question that we've debated among ourselves is art an asset class? Is it an investable asset class? Clearly, art collectors have made a lot of money in the recent years, but there are also examples of art that today is out of favor, maybe impressionism. You know, maybe there's other examples you can walk us through. And how would we think of this as an investment, as opposed to a collection of something you love? You know, hopefully it's both, but thinking of it purely from an investment perspective, how should we think about that?
Well, I think a lot of it is time-based, and a lot of us are grown up thinking that impressionist paintings like Monet are at the top of the heap. The trophy paintings are always going to go up. A trophy Monet water lily will do just fine. A trophy Giacometti will do just fine. But I think what happened was that after World War II, a lot of soldiers came back, and we all came with a taste for things French. So when I moved to New York as a student, I would go to apartments on Fifth Avenue, and everyone had Louis furniture and impressionist paintings and ornate gold frames, and there'd be molding and swathing drapery. In the 80s, that sort of changed. And there was a lot of chintz and a lot of academic 19th century painting. And today, the Google boys and the tech people are people who are making the money. A street scene in rural France that you might find in a Sisley or Pizarro doesn't relate to them, whereas contemporary art does. So I think there's a real shift American art, traditional art, was always collected privately. It wasn't a market big at auction, and it still isn't. And there are still collectors for Hopper. There are still collectors for Mary Cassatt. There are still collectors for William Merritt Chase for 19th century American painting. Not as many, but it's a much quieter, flatlined market. But there's still the clients.
If someone were to say, look, I've got a portfolio of $100 million and I want to take, let's say, 5% of my portfolio and I want to invest in art as an asset class without regard necessarily to, I like this type of painting or that, and they were to engage you and say, let's build a portfolio of artwork, how would you start them down that path? If you're looking at today, what would give people the best chance at a very solid return on their investment, what path might you lead them down?
There's certain artists who are established mid-career artists. Those artists who made their generations. So if you like Basquiat, you can't perhaps afford the $100 million Basquiat, but a great Basquiat on paper. If you like minimal, everyone's taste has to come into play here because the possibilities are endless. Yes, you buy a Monet water lily. Will it go up like that? No, it'll go up like that. So you might want to take the money and divide it into blue chip, red chip, very risk-taking. You build the portfolio that fits the individual.
Barbara, how do you create a strategy that differentiates your collections from others and makes your collection important?
I think that that comes a lot from you. And I can only tell you about some of my clients. Many who are in the film business view themselves as artists collecting the works of other artists. So someone like Steven Spielberg, as a director and as a storyteller, there's no mistake why he would want Norman Rockwell, who was the greatest storyteller of the early 20th century, as he was the greatest storyteller of the late 20th century. Steven and George Lucas, who's opening his own museum, narrative art. So that's how he differentiated himself. But it was natural. It's not an artificial kind of thing. And Steven, as a director, also has a real sense of point of view. He would love Pizarro from the balcony of a house looking down at the street, or an opera from a box looking down at the orchestra. That would be one possibility. I have one client who only collects minimal art. He says he has chaotic personal life, chaotic business life, and when he comes home, he wants peace and calm. And everybody in the market knows that if they have a good Don Judd or a good Richard Serra to call him, that he might be a logical candidate for it. So not everything is universally collected by tons and tons and tons of people. Some markets have five or six active buyers in them, and everybody knows who those people are. But you want to sort of position your client, or I would want to position my client, so they would receive the first phone call.
What are the hottest parts of the market today, and what are the out-of-favor parts of the art market today?
The 19th century is flat-lined, except for the masterpiece pictures. And again, that's part because of taste and the way people live, and it's part because they don't relate to those things anymore. I think the Black artists are super hot at the moment. Older women, deceased women, and some Chinese artists, but not all. So the market is starting to get selective in certain areas. I think that's what happened. So the NFT market, for example, is a perfect way of seeing that. You just go into Super Rare or any of the other platforms, and there are thousands and thousands of NFTs. So how do you differentiate a good one from a bad one? What is it about them that people want? And I think with NFTs, if you want to discuss that,
yeah,
the buyer of an NFT is generally a young man who's come out of gaming and makes his money in crypto or makes his money. And they're looking for a community They want to talk to the artist. They want to talk to other collectors. So they're not looking for a one-off image. They're looking, let's say, cyberpunk, where you have the figure in different poses. So they're looking to collect the different poses, almost like baseball cards, so they can talk in these rooms, chat rooms, about what they've bought. And I think we can underestimate that the one reason for collecting is that it puts you into a different world and a very interesting.
Do you see long-term value in NFTs?
I think it's going to shake out like everything else. The problem is that, for example, I think it was the British Museum has just minted a series of Turner watercolors. So they're taking images of Turner watercolors and they put them on the market for something like $5,500. They retained one. They called 9 of them super rare, 7 of them ultra rare. But a criticism that I read said, hey, wait a minute, these are nothing but reproductions. And if you can sell a reproduction with under the aegis of art, then what do you really need the Elgin marbles in England anymore? We can make perfect copies of them and send the Elgin marbles back to Greece. And this has sort of rocked the art world. I think that those pieces that will make it from the art world to the NFT world are those artists who generally work with video and understand Adobe Illustrator, all the different apps, and can make things move. I sold 3 NFTs this week that came with analog paintings and an NFT. I think there's going to be a lot of combine pieces.
So I think a lot of the people who are going to watch this podcast are 50 years or older, a lot of them. And they hear NFT, and you brought this up. Just mechanically, can you talk a little bit about how do you go about buying an NFT and where is the intrinsic value in it?
It's a tough one. Most payments are in Ether, so you do have to get involved in that. Although the auction houses, I think, are selling NFTs and taking dollars. I can only tell you the story of my assistant. I sent her to a conference on NFTs, and 400 people attended, and they all got a swag bag. And 300 lost their swag bag, 100 kept theirs. In it was an NFT, which she sold recently for $625,000.
Wow. That's quite a swag bag.
Yeah, exactly. Did they know they were giving out something that would be worth $625,000? And now it's a million. I don't think so. But that's the speculation that's going on there. And the reason for collecting is very, very different than most people who collect contemporary art.
So getting back to more traditional artwork. When you started building your collection, you know, the most obvious thing is you take it home and you hang it on your wall and you enjoy it. But what do you do with the art? How do you protect the art, the insurance market for it, protecting it from theft? I mean, especially if you're collecting reasonably valuable pieces. As a collector, what are some of the options after you purchased the painting in protecting the value?
Well, I'll get to that in a minute. But before you even get to that, you have to do your due diligence. If you buy a contemporary artist that's come from the gallery that got it from the artist, there's no due diligence to do. As for the price, you ask the gallery the price. You've tried to negotiate. Generally, artists and dealers split 50-50 when they're very young. And as the artists become more powerful, the percentage that the artist makes of the deal raises. So I think Lichtenstein in his prime was getting 70% and the gallery was getting 30%. On really hot artists, don't expect to get anything off. But maybe you might get 10%, maybe 15, maybe 20, just about maximum of any artist that's significant today. If it's on the secondary market, that means it's been out in the world, then you have other problems. Then you have to deal with the authenticity. And everybody says, oh, check the provenance. Well, Thomas Hoving, who was the head of the Metropolitan Museum, wrote, provenance? I can tell you that this painting belonged to the Queen of Sheba. That. I mean, anybody can say anything. So it's very difficult to trace provenance that you're given. Maybe the foundations of the artist or the catalog raisonné, if there is one. And then you have to find the reigning expert in the subject, which is not always easy, and you might have to pay them some money for their letter of authentication. And then you have to deal with condition. You bring in an independent restorer and see if it's in good condition. I can remember once a new buyer called me up and said, I bought this painting, I didn't really like it. And I looked at it and I said, you know, there's a big, big gash in this painting. And he took out the conservation report he got from the dealer and it said, a small rip has been repaired. Well, it was 13 inches long. So you have to do your own due diligence. Once you get it, you put it on your insurance, which is very inexpensive. And for all places and all locations and in transit. And that protects you if you want to lend the painting to museums, which I assume you would like to do. Most paintings, you can put them under protective glass. Most people don't. I once sold a Wesselman nude and put it above the bed of a client's house. And the next Sunday morning, I got a call and he said, Barbara, come over. And I said, what's the matter? He said, it's an emergency. Well, I don't get too many painting emergencies. So I ran over. He led me upstairs. I was single at the time and I thought, uh-oh. And we got upstairs and he pointed to the painting and there was a hole in the painting. And I looked in and I said, that get there? And he looked down and he went, toe hole. And so things happened to me. So he had a rough night and someone's toe went through the painting. I've had calls where hockey pucks have gone into paintings in the entry hall of people's homes. I've had a client who insisted that he hang his own painting. And when he backed up, he took the hammer and nail, put it in, and he backed up and he stepped through the painting. So please, whatever you do, use professionals to hang your paintings.
Is there any insurance against that type of damage?
Yes, theft and damage. It's very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. I think $1 per 1,000 or something. Really not expensive. And then the question becomes, do you believe it's your responsibility to lend? As a civic responsibility. And I think a lot of people do. As one of my friends said, you know, what propelled me to collect? I wanted to be a city father. And I had two choices, the opera or the art museum. And he said, if I'd given money to the opera, I figured I'd have to sit through 5 hours of Wagner over and over and over. But a few weekends of perspicacious shopping got me on the board of the museum. And so I think those people who are generous to museums also get first choice in the galleries and get preferential treatment.
Is there an advantage to having one of your paintings at a museum?
Yes, it's kind of like a piece of luggage. If it's a good show, remember when we were growing up, everybody put stickers on the side of their luggage. Yes, when you turn your painting around, there are labels that museums and galleries adhere to the back because you want the painting to have exposure at the very best possible shows.
If you do own art and you choose to sell it, what does that look like? What's the process to sell a painting, for example, and what are the commissions or markup or markdown that you pay when you sell?
You bring up a good question, which is transaction fees that the auction houses are now quite high. A lot of collectors are preferring to buy and sell privately rather than at auction. But the mechanism I would do is what I would do if the paintings were mine. I would go to Sotheby's or go to Christie's or maybe both and say, what would be the estimate? Would you give a guarantee? I'd never put a valuable painting in an auction without getting a guarantee. But the problem with the guarantee is you want the house to guarantee. You don't want them to go shopping to the likely candidates because they could burn your picture before the picture even comes up for auction by getting a third-party guarantee. So you would try and get a house guarantee. And then you would maybe go to one dealer or two dealers in that field and say, what do you think? Because it could be a very different take. No one's an expert in everything.
For example, if you were selling a $1 million painting, what would be the transaction cost?
It scales down, but it's 12% for the buyer.
So just going back a second to, if somebody's thinking about beginning an art collection and doing it for the purposes of an investment, what is the minimum amount of money that you'd say, look, you'd really want to commit at least $100,000, $50,000, $1 million, I mean, to really sort of start this process?
It depends. I think you can do it almost on any budget you want. If it was the lower end, I would say you have to stick to photos. You have to stick to good prints. And that means not just any print. It means those artists who've made contribution to printmaking, like Jasper Johns, for example, or like David Hockney, for example, or Picasso. They didn't just make an image and send it off to a printer. They were involved in the printmaking process. If you're talking about original art, you could probably, I would say, no less than a couple of $100,000 if you want to be safe.
Mm-hmm. What are the warnings you would give to anybody who's thinking? What are the don't do's you would offer to anybody who was thinking of getting into collecting art?
I think if somebody tells you that this painting is going to be three times what it is in 5 years, I don't think anybody has that crystal ball. Warhol is an interesting artist because he doesn't go up incrementally. And I think that's how the art market is different from other financial instruments. So that Warhol will go up and then he'll plateau a few years and then he'll go up and then he'll plateau. So it depends what part of the cycle you're in. I think that's one of the no's. Don't make any assumptions.
It seems at this point that most asset categories that are accessed by the ultra affluent, whether it's high-end homes, jets, yachts, are at historic valuations. And one could argue that there will be a leveling off or maybe even a sort of retracement down in valuation. Would you say that's also true for the art world, or is the art world immune in some way from valuation corrections?
No, we have our corrections, definitely. But it may be a segment of the market that's corrected. Like there was a big run on Chinese art 10 years ago, and now that's sort of leveled out. Maybe everybody who wanted it has sort of pervaded the field, and now it's just not interesting to the next generation of collectors. And that's what happens. Generations move very quickly. But certain areas will move more than others, and those are the ones you want to look at, areas of opportunity.
And what are those areas of opportunities as you see it today?
Well, I still think it's Black artists, and I still think, in a funny way, why shouldn't a great painting be $50 million? It's rarer than a great house. Look how many $50 million houses there are. I think for the trophy objects, there's no stopping. And that's been the wisdom, even when there's the correction going on. Best of the best always sticks. And that's what I would advise anyone. I don't care what you're doing, but make sure it's the best of the best.
I guess as we close out, I think this was extremely interesting, very informative for people who are interested in beginning to collect art or looking at art as an investment. How do most of your clients come to engage you? And I would say for anybody who might be interested in taking this to the next step, what is the best way to do that?
You can buy my book because it's a fun read and it'll tell you a lot about the art world. I think to pick an art advisor is to pick someone you really want to be in life with, because you are. It's a journey that you go through together, and you better get along and you better be on the same wave frequency. I charge generally a percentage of success. I'm success-based. Whereas sometimes I always say to people, just pay me for what I tell you not to buy, and I would make far much more money. Sometimes I work on a retainer basis. It depends on the client and on what they're doing.
Well, this has been incredibly insightful, Barbara. We really appreciate you taking the time, and we encourage anybody who's listening to this to reach out to us, we'll put you in contact with Barbara, and we'll make that connection if you're interested.